This podcast contains the personal stories, opinions, and experiences of its speakers rather than those of Breast Cancer Now. Welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast, providing support and information to anyone affected by breast cancer. I'm Laura Price, and I'm the host of the Breast Cancer Now podcast. I'm a food writer and author, and I live with secondary breast cancer. Today, we are talking to Toril Shah and Krina Diman, founders of the South Asian Supernovas that aims to improve breast cancer awareness and outcomes for the South Asian community. Toril is the nutritional scientist behind The Urban Kitchen, which teaches people to improve their physical, mental, and social well-being in a variety of ways. She's a trained chef with a very impressive amount of academic qualifications, and she's had breast cancer not once, not twice, but three times, with her first diagnosis at the age of 29. Krina has also had breast cancer, having been diagnosed at 33, and she has a remarkable story that has inspired a podcast, as well as regular speaking, writing, and media appearances. Krina became infertile from cancer treatment and heart failure, and now has four children, including triplets, through surrogacy. This sparked the idea for the Intended Parents podcast, where she and her co-host talk to different guests about unconventional routes to motherhood. Krina and Toril, welcome to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
So I've given the very short version of who you are and what you do, but I'd love you to introduce yourselves. So Toril, we'll start with you.
So I'm Toril. I've had breast cancer three times, but actually my world was always going to be at cancer. I knew at the age of 11, as a very precocious child, that I wanted to work in cancer because I read a book about a cancer surgeon. And so for me, that meant going to medical school. And I was thinking I wanted to be an oncologist. But when I was at medical school, my mother had breast cancer. And I realized what the oncologist actually does. Because when you're 16 and applying for university, you have absolutely no idea. You have no idea what the jobs actually mean. So mum, you know, had breast cancer when I was at university. And I remember thinking, so she's having surgery, she's having chemotherapy, she's having radiotherapy, she's having hormone treatment. But what happens after that? What happens when you've been through all the treatment and you want to get your life back on track? And your mum's had a year of treatment. And how do you get your life back? And that's when I really started looking into nutrition. And I realized at medical school, we learned nothing about nutrition and kind of really helping people's holistic well-being after this kind of cancer diagnosis. So I had a really difficult time deciding what to do. And I actually ended up leaving medicine, which was, you know, if you're a South Asian person like me, that is literally the parents' worst nightmare. Although my parents were very cool about it. Worked in research for a while, had a bit of a break, and then actually went back and did a master's in nutritional medicine. And I was just about finishing the taught part of that course when I just felt a lump. And I was doing a lot of training. I was training for a triathlon. And so I was very, very lean. So this lump was even more kind of pronounced. And I showed my mum. She said, let's wait a cycle and see what happens. And so I did. And then she said, let's go and see the doctor. My GP is a really close family. At the time, was a very close family friend. So he was like, wait till the new female GP starts next week. And so we waited, saw her. She sort of didn't take me seriously. So A, being 29, despite my having a family history, my mum had already had breast cancer. My aunt already had breast cancer. But she was like, no, you're too young. And so I just wasn't diagnosed for a couple of months actually. And the only reason I got diagnosed because my mum works in the NHS and yeah, there's ways and means around the system. And so for me, that was really the first kind of experience of being discriminated against, being really young and not being heard and listened to despite having this ridiculously strong family history. Mm-hmm. So 29 years old, diagnosed with breast cancer, super, you know, it was a real shock. And actually I had very early stage, mostly DCIS, which is ductal carcinoma in situ, which is trapped in your milk ducts, but a little bit of kind of microinvasion to stage one. And so I had to have a mastectomy. And for me, being very, very body conscious, that was literally the worst nightmare. So had the mastectomy, was supposed to be in hospital for my 30th birthday, decided to leave. And luckily they let me leave because I was recovering quite well and ended up just having hormone treatment. I didn't have any other treatment because they, you know, medically it wasn't necessary. And, you know, I was very involved in my treatment. So, you know, off you go with your life. And I was already working, you know, my master's thesis was already on breast cancer and what you can do from a diet and lifestyle perspective to reduce the risk of reoccurrence. So my life was already wrapped up in cancer. I was doing lots of work in this field. and, you know, continue to grow my business in that way. And you get to the 5-year mark and you think, okay, this is cool. I'm past the 5-year mark. You get to the 10-year mark and you think, great, I don't need to think about this again. And so in the meantime, I'm building my business. I'm a nutritional scientist, an integrative oncology practitioner. I'm doing loads of qualifications. I'm constantly training, helping, you know, breast cancer patients, other cancer patients all the time. And then 12 and a half years in, my scar from my mastectomy started to feel weird. There's nothing else I can say other than it felt odd. And I think that's where knowing your normal is so important. And so there became the process of trying to be, you know, diagnosed. But no, again, no one really took me seriously. I kept saying this feels odd. And no one really took me seriously. It took me a couple of months to get diagnosed again. I have an amazing team at the Marsden. So once I'm diagnosed, everything happens quickly. And, you know, it got to the point where, what do we do? Because this is a little stage one cancer, but in the skin of the mastectomy. Because I'd never had radiotherapy, that's always a risk if you have a mastectomy, because a couple of cells are always left. So had the surgery. And then again, the conversation was, do we give you radiotherapy or not? And they agonized over it. Over 3 months it took. 3 MDTs later, and like they're like, no, but we'll just give you hormone treatment again. But I've never been able to tolerate tamoxifen. That's a whole other conversation that we could have another time. And so, you know, off we went, and that was the end of that. And then, you know, in the pandemic, I was having regular PET scans. In the pandemic, just before the pandemic, in February 2020, had a PET scan that wasn't quite right, and they couldn't tell because I had developed some sort of dermatitis on the kind of on the breast. And they're like, oh, we don't know if it's dermatitis or breast cancer. I'm like, well, you might want to figure it out. Anyway, pandemic happened and the ball got dropped by everybody, you know, not just the team, but myself too. So fast forward over that kind of big summer where we're all kind of out and about, and like, I just started to get so much pain in my shoulder and my kind of around my neck area. And I just thought, this is not right. So called 17 times before someone really took notice of me. And then I just bypassed the kind of process and went straight to my surgeon secretary. And you know, again, breast cancer, reoccurrence in the skin, but obviously a bit more extensive and trying to grow into the muscle, because I had previously had a mastectomy with implant reconstruction. And so we're going back into lockdown and I'm going back into treatment. And that was really hard. So I had a Dieppe flap. I had a mastectomy again, which is really weird, given that I've already had a mastectomy, but kind of a mastectomy of the kind of implant reconstruction, and then a Dieppe flap reconstruction, and then radiotherapy, and then hormone treatment, which again, I'm just poorly, I'm not able to tolerate tamoxifen, and I've actually given that up. And that's a whole, something I talk about quite a lot. But so I think the end of story of this is, you have to be vigilant. And I think there's a risk of being hypervigilant as somebody who's had cancer, not just once, twice, but 3 times. And so I have to constantly work with my nervous system to calm that down. And luckily I have lots of tools in my toolbox from the work I do with patients, but it's really hard because, you know, we know that, and I think you know more than better than us, that 20 to 30% of primary breast cancer patients progress to, you know, having reoccurrence. Mm-hmm. And we don't even know what the statistics are, whether it's, you know, secondary or whether it's actually a local reoccurrence, which is primary, like me, or what it is. So I think we just have to be, as much as you think that, you know, 5 years, 10 years, you're out, you have to be a little bit aware, and you have to be very aware of your own normal and be constantly checking. And that's not to scare people, but it's just to be, with hormone-driven cancers like mine, so I'm very estrogen-positive breast cancer, they can come return at any time up to 30 years. And I think life events, and I could tell you a little about the science, but I'm not going to in this particular episode, but why the things I think that kind of helped the cancer feel like, you know, start growing again. And, you know, we've got some great data for that now, but I think it's, you know, the moral of the story is, like, just keep an eye and know your body, because no one else, other people might be the experts in cancer, but you're the expert in your own body.
You've raised so many important points there and so many familiar things. Karina and I were both nodding our heads furiously throughout, because, you know, I was diagnosed at 29 as well. And so many people listening to this podcast will have experienced a similar thing, where their symptoms were initially perhaps dismissed or perhaps misdiagnosed. Mm. And the importance of knowing your own body and knowing when something is not normal or not right is just so important. So thank you for talking about that. Loads of other points, which we'll come back onto in a bit. Karina, why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do and also about your breast cancer diagnosis?
Yeah, sure. So I guess
up until last year, I was a corporate accountant, you know, and my work in this space was always a bit of a side hustle. And over the years, so over the 8 years of working here, I've realised that actually my passion is here. And I think part of life after cancer, we have a whole new perspective, don't we, on what we want to do and what we want to leave behind on this earth. And for me, it was like, you know, an opportunity came last year to sort of quit that corporate rat race and to really put my heart and soul into saving people's lives ultimately, or enriching them. And so I made the jump and haven't really looked back because of the work we're doing in this space and other projects. So obviously we'll talk more about the South Asian Supernovas that Doral and I have co-founded. But then I also am co-founder of The Intended Parent, which is a support platform now to help women or couples or single people going through surrogacy in the UK, because we know how sensationalized it is, how much sort of stigma and taboos associated with that path to parenthood, and how tricky it is given sort of the legal implications of surrogacy in the UK, which is a whole other conversation. So what I wanted to do along with my co-host there is initially set up a free podcast, a free resource to smash the conversations that were on TV, you know, about surrogacy is risky, surrogacy is this, surrogacy is that, it's just going to take your baby. And, you know, we have between myself and Fran, we have six very beautiful, healthy children, and we've not experienced the adversity you hear about in the press. So we wanted to put that out there because for me, you know, a cancer diagnosis, yes, it happens, but what happens after that? Like Thoral was saying, her move away from medicine into sort of her current work was because she wanted to help people beyond their cancer diagnosis. And I feel that same way when it comes to fertility and motherhood. And I think that so many of us feel that we're robbed of motherhood when we hit a cancer diagnosis. And I want to advocate that you're not, because that's what I was once told. The line I often quote from my oncologist was that his job was to save my life, not to create a new life. And that hit really hard as a South Asian girl who was newly married and always expected to have children. And so I moved heaven and earth to have my kids. And I want other people to know that it's an option and that hopefully we've made it a little bit easier for them. So The Intended Parent is one of my babies. I then, have other things that I do around sort of advocacy. So we mentioned that I'd gone into heart failure following chemotherapy. That's something that I feel is still not talked about that much, cardiotoxic chemotherapy and the impact it has on us. So I work with the International Society of Cardio-Oncology to raise awareness of, you know, what heart disease can look like after chemotherapy and what we should be looking for. So that's another thing that I do. And then generally just sharing my story, podcasting, writing. I'm in the process of getting a book sort of written and published. So that's also happening. So it's all, you know, very exciting stuff. And it stems from a cancer diagnosis at the age of 33. I had no idea that breast cancer happened in younger women. And this is despite sort of a familial history of my maternal grandmother having experienced breast cancer twice when I was in my teens, but as a family we never spoke about it. So we knew that something was wrong with my gran, but we didn't know what, and the C word was never really mentioned. And she would go to radiotherapy on sort of the hospital ambulance. No one would take her because she didn't want to pick people out. She didn't want people to sort of be a bit of a pity party for her, and she didn't want to be a burden. Then I also think there was most likely an element of shame associated with it that just wasn't spoken about. And I feel so sad for her now, because I think it must have been so lonely. A woman who didn't really speak English having to turn up at a hospital where people probably didn't understand her. She must have been petrified, and she didn't have a loved one with her because she didn't want to be a burden. And it's such a complex conversation in our community with our elders. Of, we support them in so many ways. You know, we translate their letters from the government from them, you know, we pay their utility bills for them, we do all of these daily admin things, but when it comes to their health, there's a degree of secrecy when it comes to like chronic disease, because I don't know if they feel like they've let us down. You know, we talk about this, Thoral and I, a lot in the South Asian Supernovas, that colonization has really imprinted on our grandparents, and you know, they had to really struggle to fit in societally. They had to sort of endure so much adversity that they, I think, felt the need to be perfect, to be accepted. And I think that sort of filtered into our generation, where you see all the doctors and accountants and, you know, highly academic people who are studying to then find acceptance. And therefore, we've been conditioned to not
share our vulnerabilities. And I think what I really want to do with South Asian Supernovas is to break that and to remind people that vulnerability is their greatest strength. So, you know, that was a story for my grandmother. You know, we fast forward sort of a decade or so beyond her passing, and I find an inverted nipple, and I joke with my husband about it and say, oh, what have I worn? My bra must have been really badly fitting because my nipple's gone in. And I joke about it for another week and, you know, think, what on earth's going on here? Not for a second thinking it could be breast cancer. And then 2 weeks later, he's like, I think you should go to the doctor because that's not normal. And I sort of think, once my husband says something like, go to the doctor, I take it a bit seriously because he never goes to the doctor. You know, he would never suggest that. Or so I thought, oh, right. And I remember, say clearly, it was a Sunday afternoon and I started Googling what an inverted nipple is. And then there were the signs, you know, and symptoms coming up. I'd also had shooting pain in my breast, but I was doing a lot of training. I was doing body pump and, you know, I thought I've just lifted too much weight and pulled a muscle. So let it be then. You know, the sign was there when I look at it now. Called the doctor on the Monday, explained everything, explained my fears, and then was told that they thought it was very unlikely that this was breast cancer. I initially went through to a receptionist. Receptionist put me through to a doctor on duty, to on-call doctor. And I think when you're young and you haven't had an illness, you don't really have a regular GP, so they don't know you as a person. They don't know what's normal for you. So she just said, oh, right, yeah, no, you're very young, you know. From what I can see, you don't have any issues with sort of weight or, you know, I told her I was a non-smoker, non-drinker, really. So she was like, your risk factors are very low. This isn't going to be breast cancer. Given your age and you don't have children, it's most likely a blocked milk duct. Book the next routine appointment. So rather than getting in the next few days, it was a week before I got in. When I then got in, the GP sort of felt my breast and, you know, she gaslit me. And she just said, there's nothing wrong with you, you know, and I can't feel a lump, you know, that this is nothing to be worried about. You've got a blocked milk duct. Go away, you know, keep an eye on it over the coming weeks and months and come back if it doesn't resolve. By that point, I'd done a lot of research and I think I'm quite a tenacious person, you know, and I was like, hold on, this, now I've done the research, I know that this isn't normal and I need to self-advocate. So I basically sat in her chair while she sort of told me that it was useless going to have a mammogram and there's no point referring me. And I was like, well, I'll take the referral anyway because I'm entitled to it. And we had a lot of back and forth. And very begrudgingly, I got a referral, pretty much because I refused to leave without one. And then, you know, the motions start of you getting called in to the specialist breast care unit and all of that. So I went in and I, you know, the consultant first said to me, have you come on your own, when I went to an appointment? And I said, yes, because the GP said there's nothing wrong with me. And she was like, well, you know, there's one, if not two lumps in your breast combined with an inverted nipple. I've got real cause for concern. I want to get you biopsied and mammogrammed immediately. So I was a bit like, got in a state of shock because I just thought I was going to get the all clear. Over the next few days, you know, everything just happened very quickly. I was mammogrammed and then called in for a biopsy and ultrasound. When I went to the biopsy, the person who was carrying out that procedure hadn't read the registrar or consultant's note. They'd only read the doctor's note. So they were like, oh, why are you here and why have you brought someone with you? There's nothing wrong with you. And I was like, no, the consultant has confirmed there's two lumps in my breast. She's like, no, the GP's report says there's nothing wrong with your breast. And I was like, no, there is, because I can actually now feel them. This is weeks on. She goes, well, you don't need anyone in the room. This is going to be a 2-minute job. Leave her outside. So we had an argument about whether my friend could come in or not. And I got on the bed and just really angrily said, well, just do the ultrasound and I'm sure you'll call her in a minute. And exactly, you know, that happened within seconds of that machine going on my breast. They said, call her friend in. We're going to biopsy her. They then took what felt like 10 to 12 samples. They did take a lot. There were two masses in my breast. And it was sort of August holiday time and we were coming up to a bank holiday. And once the procedure was done, I said to her, the consultant told me you'd be able to give me an indication of what you might have seen. And she just turned around. She goes, yeah, it doesn't look good. And that was it.
Wow.
That was it. And so my best friend was like, she scooped me up. You know, I was in tears and she just said, let's go and get a hot chocolate and talk about this. And I think that was a point at which I really knew that I had breast cancer. I didn't obviously know the extent of it, but she then, my friend, confirmed to me, because she was like, I saw the screen, you know, there's something there, so we can't sort of dress this up in anything other than there's something serious to worry about. And as the weeks went past, you know, I was told it would be 10 days because there were some bank holidays and that was on a Friday. I got a call on the Monday to say, can you come in to see the consultant? So I knew by that point you don't get results one day later, one working day later anyway, if it's nothing to worry about. And by Wednesday, we were in for to see the breast surgeon. And my husband and I went in and his words to me were, Queena, you've got some naughties in your breast.
Wow.
And I looked at him and I was like, are you trying to say I've got breast cancer? And he goes, yes. And I said, I'd rather we just call it what it is, because I'm not a 5-year-old that you need to say it's like a naughty or a boo-boo or something like that. This is cancer and we need to deal with it. We need to call it out for what it is. We went into that appointment. I expected to hear that news, so I guess I'd prepared for it. My husband, however, hadn't. He was very much burying his head in the sand. And as soon as the words landed, he just cried. And I'd never seen him cry in my whole relationship up until that point. And I think that brought with it so much hurt for me. I think I then started to feel responsible for other people's pain. And just a very complex journey there on in with, you know, the disease itself and then the repercussions of how that impacted my family and how I shared my family. I think what we have is very different. Doral's family were very open, and because of her mum's diagnosis, they spoke openly about it. Whereas my family didn't really have any knowledge of how to deal with it in that way. And so I became their protector and almost became apologetic for what was happening to me. And then I was like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. Convincing them when inside you're just crumbling. And it was really tricky. And I didn't share my diagnosis news really with anyone outside my immediate family and my bestest friends for a good 2 to 3 months until I'd started chemotherapy. And it became impossible to hide what was going on.
Karina, you've just said so many shocking things that, to me, a person who's been part of this breast cancer community for 11 and a half years, I'm shocked by some of the things you've just told me about the treatment that you've had from medical professionals in this country. Mm. So I'm sorry that that happened to you. And I'm sorry that people, you know, of a young age are being dismissed. And I'm actually getting quite emotional just hearing your both of your stories. There are so many things that resonated with me from what you said, so I'm going to have to remember some of them. But one of the things that I wanted to go back to was you talking about how, as a South Asian woman, you were expected to have children, and you felt shame around some of the things that happened in your diagnosis, some of the ways that you were treated, the ways you came to talk or not talk about your breast cancer diagnosis with your community, which brings us all on to the South Asian Supernovas. So tell me why you set up this organisation and what you're hoping to achieve with it, please.
Karina and I actually met online in the pandemic, and this particular conversation about the outcomes of and the impact on the South Asian community has been part of my life, you know, since, you know, for the last 20 years. Yeah, you know, I was discriminated against, and I didn't realize the extent of which until a few years later. And part of it was obviously the age thing, but secondly, you know, being South Asian. And I knew from the conversations I was having with other members in the community, you know, extended family, that, you know, there's a lot of secrecy, a lot of shame. And then Karina and I met online, and we knew that we wanted to start something and talk about in this space. But, you know, as the pandemic happened, she had triplets. I had breast cancer again. Her mum died. My dad died. So it took us a little while to kind of get ourselves together. But the main thing is, we know that the outcomes, like Black women, are much poorer. And we know that there's layers and nuances of our culture and a culture and condition that impact us very differently than the white population. So, for example, when we talk about the fertility and having children, as South Asian women, we're expected to have children. And for me, being child free is still a huge source of hurt and pain. And part of that is not meeting someone, but part of it is the cancer diagnosis, because if I get pregnant now, it's very dangerous for me because of the estrogen spikes. And we know from Karina's journey that people just don't talk about these things. The second thing is the hair. Mm. Our hair is our crowning glory. And from the age of, you know, being very small, your hair's oiled, your head is massaged, they're combing your hair. It's always about having long hair. I remember when I cut my hair at university, my dad didn't talk to me for 3 days. Mm. You know, these are the things, even in liberal modern families, it is just part and parcel of your life. And then there's a whole thing about how breast cancer impacts our health in different ways, or the impact of our health on breast cancer. For example, if you have type 2 diabetes, which is so hugely prevalent in the South Asian community, 6 times more likely. You're more, approximately 20% more likely to have breast cancer. And doctors and people do not talk about this. Mm. They don't talk about their metabolic health and how that impacts it. They don't talk about the kind of how your cardiovascular health could be impacted by treatment. So Karina will tell you more about cardiotoxicity. But what we know is that we're more likely to have cardiovascular health issues, and maybe by genetic screen or by other testing, we could find that out before you stop treatment. And then people don't have to go through what Karina went through. And so we knew there was a space to try and change outcomes. And it wasn't just from like providing a support space. This is about talking to healthcare organizations, doctors, healthcare professionals, charities, to really look at understanding, breaking down, unpicking the taboos, the myths, but also why we have these issues and why breast cancer out and we're being diagnosed so late, why we're not attending routine screening, why? Because people, the communications that are out there are not for our community. I'll let Karina share a bit more.
Yeah, so following on from that, I think the hair is a big thing. Like, actually, so I didn't cry the day I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I cried the day I found out I had to have chemotherapy. My original treatment plan was going to be radiotherapy. Then when they checked lymph nodes, they said, we're going to have to switch to chemotherapy. At that point, my world fell apart because I thought, I'm going to lose the hair on my head. And I cold capped even on a bald head just to preserve front fringing so people could... I mean, in my head, wouldn't know I was bald, but everyone knew I was bald. I never showed my mum my bald head, not once through my entire diagnosis. I remember similarly at 16, I went from waist bump length hair, which I'd had my entire life, to a bob, because I was just feeling rebellious. And I was like, God, I'm so fed up with my mum telling me the line is like, your hair is your beauty. Your hair is your beauty. No one will marry you if you've got short hair. And yeah, Marriageability is a big thing we talk about and the tick boxes of our lives. And again, I cut my hair to bob and she didn't talk to me for a week. And she told me I'd lost all my beauty and that no one would marry me. And so then when I fast forward from 16 to 33 and now I'm going to lose every hair on my head, I couldn't show it to her. Because such is the imprint of that conditioning, and it's really painful. So I think hair loss is traumatic for any of us. Hair loss in the South Asian community seems to have another layer attached to it, and that's not something that's talked about. And one of the things, when I remember, actually, you know, Dora and I started talking online, but I'd been following her and her work for way before, and I was sort of like, who can I work with to, you know, who in this space is going to have the same passion? And I sort of was watching everything she was doing and like approached her then to say, look, let's do this. And we came together. And I think, you know, watching another woman talk openly about breast cancer was really empowering to me and allowed me to then be more vulnerable and have these conversations. And one thing I used to speak up about was that I had my mastectomy without reconstruction and went into a fitting for a prosthetic and was just told I had to wear a white woman's prosthetic because they didn't stock them in black or brown skin tones. And now I'm like, hold on, I've never seen a white woman have to wear a black or brown one. So why are the brown women being asked to wear white ones? You know, that's just horrendous. I went for a wig fitting and I was given a blonde wig to try on. You know, you can see that I've got black hair. And he said, we haven't got many black or dark South Asian style wigs, so why don't you put this blonde one on? And if you like the style, we'll get a suitable colour match. And I was a bit like, I did it. And I've got the photo of me wearing it. And I'm a bit like, now I look back and I'm like, that's added trauma that a white woman doesn't have to go through. Mm-hmm. But I have to, because I'm a person of colour.
And lymphedema sleeves. And lymphedema, as well.
Yeah. So then that went into lymphedema clinic. Again, I got lymphedema, and they put it on, and they're like, "This is our nude one." And I'm like, "Nude for who?" Because that's not a nude for me, yeah. You know. And then the movement sort of came out on Instagram as well that nude is not one color, and you know, petitions were launched, and we need to do more to have, you know, sleeves that match people's skin tone. Because again, you go out, you're wearing a short sleeve dress, it's triggering when everyone asks you, "What's wrong with your arm?" Because it's so obvious that you're wearing a sleeve.
The psychological impact of not being seen and heard is it's hard. And somebody who's been dealing with breast cancer for 17 years, it's still quite cliquey, the breast cancer community, and it's still very white. Mm-hmm. And the charities have promoted that almost. So that's part of the problem as well, because we have not addressed it. And, you know, South Asians are the biggest ethnic minority in the UK. We make up between 7 to 10% of the population now. Yet we're very invisible when it comes to media. Mm. We're not seen. And if we're on TV show, we're either a shopkeeper or a doctor. There's literally nothing else. And it's really upsetting not to be able to see yourself. I've been watching these American shows over the last couple of years, you know, Never Have I Ever, and like even Bridgerton and stuff. And to seeing South Asian female protagonists, my life would have been so different if I'd seen them in my teens.
Yeah.
And had that role model. And, you know, so now Karina and I need to be the role models. Like, you know, when it comes to marriageability, like that's such a big source of shame for me and difficulty. When I was being wheeled down to have my very first lumpectomy, wide local incision, it was a South Asian anaesthetist who knew my family, knew my mother. And she said to me, "Toral, don't worry, I won't tell anyone about your breast cancer." I said, "A, Hippocratic oath and you can't. And B, why? I'm telling people, there's nothing to be ashamed of." She goes, "But I know you want to get married." I said, "Well, if they're not going to, I mean, they're going to find out breast cancer, because I don't have a breast, I have a reconstruction. This is ridiculous." And so this is the conversation I'm having as I'm being wheeled down to theatre. And this is, so it's not just external, it's internal too. Mm. We have our own cultural condition and, you know, these things which are put onto us. And I'm, you know, in our culture, if you're not married by a certain point, people introduce you. No one's ever introduced you. I fell off the shelf at 29. Mm. I literally fell off the shelf. And it, in some ways, it's made my life beautiful and brilliant and no pressure. But it's also sad. Mm. It's so sad.
And it, the impact of marriageability is huge. And, you know, once I got married and then I got my diagnosis, I had a fear that my husband's family would tell him to leave me because I was damaged goods, because I couldn't have children and because I was no longer beautiful. And, you know, one of the things I write about a lot and we talk about is the, you know, culture and cultural conditioning is that I think I spent my entire life up until the age of 28, 29, becoming marriageable. So studying so that I had a high performing job, so that I was a good earner. I owned a big house, you know, I was fertile, I had long hair, I was pretty, all of these tick boxes. And then breast cancer comes along and all those tick boxes fall away. And what's left behind is almost a hollow shell because we've not been taught to look inwards in any other way and to appreciate ourselves in any other way other than the acceptance of our potential husband. And so this is a huge issue, marriageability, and the impact of those behaviours on someone once they have had a cancer diagnosis. And also the conversations people have with people who've had a cancer diagnosis. Because then you had, I mean, when I was getting married, my parents had divorced and the community was saying, "Oh, no one will marry Karina because she comes from a divorced family." Or, you know, if you've had breast cancer before marriage, one of my friends called me and his sister-in-law had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And this is someone who knows I work in this space. The words straight from his mouth were, "Well, we did let him marry her knowing that she'd had breast cancer." And I was like, wow, you know, like this is in 2021. I'm having this conversation this many years after. I was like, why are people still being branded as damaged goods just because they've had breast cancer?
Yeah.
In fact, I think I'm a much higher quality good having had my breast cancer because I'm a better quality human being because of the empathy and appreciation of life that runs through my veins. So we have to change that narrative within our community, and we have to, acceptance is huge, acceptance of the disease, acceptance of the lifestyle it then goes on to give way to, acceptance of children born in different ways, acceptance of a woman rocking a bald head. Like, let's make it normal and let's make it be seen.
Yeah. The other thing we have to talk about is kind of the society as a whole, it's still very patriarchal, whatever culture, but particularly in our South Asian culture. Mm. So if you do get a breast cancer diagnosis or any cancer diagnosis, you're kind of expected to carry on. And as Karina touched on earlier, just like almost look after everyone else. And as much as my family talked about breast cancer and they were there for me, I still had to do that. I still had to manage people's emotional expectations within my family, but also in the way that you can't even ask for help in the way you expect it. And even this time, my third diagnosis in the pandemic, I asked my extended family for help. But their whole way was, no, you have to accept the help than what we want to give. And that's very A, centering themselves, and B, patriarchal. Because as a woman, I know what I need. I know what help I need, especially because I've done this three times before. I know what I can do on my own and I know what help I need. So there's also that aspect of kind of the culture and cultural conditioning that maybe other cultures don't have to, you know. And I know of so many cases where women are having chemotherapy, radiotherapy, surgery and expected to cooking for their husband's families and their in-laws and just look after kids, and they're just suffering.
I'm hearing from you that there is work to be done both in the healthcare community, you know, in hospitals and in support centres that are providing the sleeves and the wigs and the prosthetics. But there's also work to be done within the South Asian community in terms of educating the family members and the friends of the breast cancer patient. Let's say a South Asian person is listening to this podcast who has recently been diagnosed with breast cancer, like you both were a while ago. What advice would you give them? What would you say to them in terms of talking to their family and friends, and also talking to their healthcare providers?
I think that that's such an interesting question. It's one that I'm asked all the time. And I think what I'd like to say is quite often there are real like nuances within our community that we definitely need to iron out. But we are also, across all sort of parts of the South Asian community, a very loving community. Mm-hmm. So you only have to look when a baby's born and when someone passes and when someone gets married. Those are the, you know, biggest gatherings of people, and everyone turns up with love in those instances. So we just need to learn to extend that level of love to disease, and to therefore just talk about it so it becomes acceptable, normalize the conversations. And I think, you know, maybe with rose tinted glasses on, but you know, people will show up if they know what they need to show up for. So advocate for yourself, and like Doral says, let people know what you need from them. And make it clear where your boundary is. So actually, no, I'm not going to be able to cook for you on, you know, my week two, one and two, because I'm going to feel like awful. So we have these huge extended families. So actually, that sister-in-law can cook on that day. That, you know, that auntie can cook on that day. Line it up. Like, I think planning is really important, and asking for help, because I wasn't very good at asking for help.
We're not taught to ask for help, because we're taught to be perfect and small and academic and brilliant, and we're just not taught to be vulnerable and to know how to actually break our barriers down, but to ask for help, because we are supposed to be able to do it all, and we can't.
And that's, I mean, I'm still guilty of that to this day, you know, as a mum of four now. And like, just yesterday I said, Doral, I've been at cardiology appointments all day and I was exhausted when I got home. And it's a bit like, well, actually, do you know what, I just need to tell someone that I can't do anymore now, because we just keep, and women, you know, not only South Asian women, we keep taking it on, and then one point we'll hit breaking point, and we need to stop before that and ask for help.
And I think this is the interesting and wonderful and brilliant thing about breast cancer, is our self-worth as women, and this is all over the board, whatever culture, is so much about what we're doing, yet it really should be about who we're being. And when you have a diagnosis like breast cancer, it does make you stop and look internally. And for me, it was the beginning of a huge journey of self-development, to where I really like want to have integrity, and I'm constantly looking how I can be a better person each day. But that self-worth, it's something that we're not taught. And I think as all women, where a lot of our lives are still in the modern world about how we look, it does change things.
And how we prove ourselves societally. So For us, it's quite often being an academic or being having a vocational career and all of that. I mean, if I told my grandmother who passed away, like, I was going to leave accountancy to write a book, then, you know, they'd all be like, oh my. Even my mum was a little bit like, this is great side hustle, Karina, but please don't let go of accountancy. You know, that's what we know will bring the money in. And that stems from colonialism, from scarcity, from poverty, where our parents have come from. And, you know, I feel like having had breast cancer, we can use it in a very empowering way if we allow ourselves to. So for that patient who's just been diagnosed, one is just put some boundaries up and self-advocate. And for the healthcare professional, it's, you know, yes, provide what they need practically, but also I think there needs to be real training on how to support mentally for minority communities, because it's so very different to the counselling you get.
I'm Gareth, the editor of Vita magazine. Vita is Breast Cancer Now's magazine for anyone affected by breast cancer. It's full of inspiring real-life stories, expert tips on coping with the effects of breast cancer, and articles on health and well-being. In our new spring issue, you can read about a mother and daughter who were both diagnosed with breast cancer 12 years apart, find out the latest in breast cancer research, get tips on coping with fatigue, read about the benefits of getting outdoors, and much more. Subscribe to Vita now at breastcancernow.org/Vita.
We've talked quite a lot about what happens after you're diagnosed, how you talk to your community about it, and how the healthcare professionals deal with it. But diagnosis is also really difficult within the South Asian community, because there's shame and there's fear around going to the doctors in the first place. Towards the end of 2023, you launched a brilliant campaign talking to women in your community about going to the doctors. Can you tell us about that campaign?
Yeah, so one we know from the statistics is that South Asian women are less likely to go to A, self-check, B, have routine screening and mammograms, and C, kind of really be aware of the signs and symptoms of breast cancer. And that's where it starts, is awareness. I mean, I also would love to go into the risk factors, but we're not going to talk about that today. But like, if you don't know the signs and symptoms, how are you going to look for them? So when surveyed by Breast Cancer Now and other organisations, you know, we're coming up poorly. So we set up this campaign and we're using social media because that's the avenue we have available to us. But we're trying to use the younger generation of South Asians to educate their older members of family, mothers, aunts, grandmas, but uncles, you know, cousins, brothers, because men need to know too, because men do get breast cancer, but also they are often other ones who might notice changes more, you know, if you're in a relationship with someone. So our campaign was using an amazing group of South Asian breast cancer patients, healthcare professionals, doctors, and influencers in our community to share about the signs and symptoms, remind people of the importance of self-checking and how to do this, and also to attend routine screening, because we're the group that actually attends the least. And so, for example, like, we had, my mum was in the campaign, which is amazing, and she had her first routine mammogram, which she went along for because it just was invited, and that's when they found her breast cancer, and she had 3 tumours. And so she wouldn't have found that for ages if she hadn't had the routine. And she was younger. It was, you know, she was 49. So I think that's why this campaign for us became really, really important, because we have to start at the beginning. We have to create that awareness and what to look for and, you know, how to do this. And then Karina and I started thinking, well, how do we kind of get that message out there? And I'll let her share more about that.
Well, yeah, we basically, you know, we know that it's an issue from the data, like Doral says. We also fully acknowledge the diversity in the South Asian community. So what was important to us was that, well, Doral and I are both Gujarati girls, and that is the largest sort of minority within the South Asian community. There are so many other communities we need to be representative of, and that's probably a nuance of being a South Asian. So, you know, it's eight different
countries,
multiple languages, multiple religions, so many layers that we need to look at for this. So where some minority communities don't have to come against, you know, language being a barrier, that is for us. Religion being a barrier, that is for us. And then conditioning being a barrier, that is for us. So we wanted to do something that made it as accessible as possible. So we curated our cast knowing that. So we made sure we had Jains in the set, we made sure we had Hindus, we had Sikhs, we had Muslim people, we had a diverse range of ethnicities within there. So we wanted to make sure that as many people who saw the campaign could resonate with someone within the campaign. And what we also know is the power of the family WhatsApp group in our community. So my mother-in-law is forever showing me media on her phone that says, eat this and your toothache will go, drink this and your bellyache will go. But some of it really is just nonsense. And so we thought, well, let's use that to actually, rather than tell, we initially started it off by telling Auntie G, who is the one who forwards all of these messages, what she's doing wrong. And we thought, actually, no, let's not crush her. Let's empower her. So what we'll do is give her a message that will help her tell other people what to look for when it comes to breast cancer. So she became the focus of our campaign, the Auntie G, who we all know and love, who sometimes is a bit inappropriate with her messaging and maybe forwards misinformation. We wanted to give her the right information. So everything was created around, dear Auntie G, do you know the signs and symptoms of breast cancer? The content was created so that, yes, it sits on social media that our peers will see, but it will get onto the family WhatsApp group that all the elders will see, because that's the media that they're digesting. And I think it's important that we think about what media is the demographic we want to access actually looking at and watching. You know, they're not watching Instagram because they don't have Instagram accounts. They're not watching BBC News or This Morning or Lorraine because they don't speak English. So what are the channels? What are the radio stations? And what are the avenues that they take the information from? So we launched the campaign. It's been massively successful. And, you know, it's out there doing its thing. And I think we're both super proud of how far it's gone and what we've achieved with it in a really short time.
I'm so proud of this because the concept to output happened in less than 2 months. And, you know, for anyone who works with me knows, that is insane. Karina and I are severely sleep deprived, but I'm so proud of this.
Yeah.
It's absolutely brilliant. It's such a brilliant, powerful campaign. You know, seeing it as a white woman, not part of your community at all, but just, you know, it completely captured me. And I can see how it's really, really going to reach, you know, so many people in such a brilliant way.
Ultimately, the aim is then to sort of get the stories out of everyone who's in the campaign, get the messaging out. But we also now have the second wave, which we're recording, which is sort of multilingual self-checks and things like that, that then land on people's phones. So that it's as accessible as it can be.
Fantastic. You've both been through so much, and I actually just wanted to ask the question to each of you. How are you?
You know, it's a really good question. I think, like other cancer patients, for me, you know, things are up and down. Like, I've just had my 6-monthly PET scan, and I'm waiting with anxiety, like other people, to see what's happening. I have some active lymph nodes which have been there for, I don't know, 4 or 5 years, and it's a watch and wait situation. But otherwise, well, I just feel so grateful I have Karina, because I can talk to her about things I don't talk to about. Not that I don't have other breast cancer friends, I do, but in a way that understands kind of all the nuances of my life. And we've become like sisters, and we fight. Don't get me wrong. Yeah, one of us is always pissed off at the other, and me probably more than Karina. But I do think that having someone that you can really talk to about kind of all the intricacies makes such a difference, because especially because for me, I don't have a partner. And, you know, my family, my dad just died. You know, my brother lives in Hong Kong. It's hard. And so for me, having like this sisterhood is so important.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think it's great for anyone diagnosed with breast cancer to have a friend or a person who has breast cancer as well, or has had it, who has experienced it and who gets it, just as that support network.
And also you just like, you know, I've had so many friends over years, and sadly so many of my friends have passed away. And for me, I feel like I'm constantly in heartbreak. And so having someone, you know, literally, I don't think Karina's 4 children will let her go anywhere. So she's stuck with me too.
And how are you, Karina, and how are your kids?
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky. I feel like I'm constantly up and down. I think it's exhausting. And like one of the things Doral and I talk about is that actually this work is exhausting as well. And it's quite triggering, and it brings our trauma back to the surface. Mm-hmm. And if I'm honest, I don't think we're held enough, and we're expected to do more. So, you know, it just things like the campaign, you know, we've run that from scratch because we have no funding. We have no spot. You know, we have had one sponsor, and so therefore we're burnt out delivering it. But the messaging is important. So we really need investment, if I'm honest, to help alleviate the burden on us. But then otherwise, you know, like we didn't talk too much about my heart failure, but the one thing that really scares me is the impact of my heart, because it's a lifelong condition now. And I really want people to know that if they struggle with breathing and stuff after chemo, to get it checked, because I don't want people to be as severe as me. I was, you know, fatal with my heart failure. And so yesterday I spent the whole day in cardiology, and, you know, there's fear about my heart regressing, and then comes a fear of potentially leaving my children. And I was talking to my friend Emma, who I found at crossing the road at the Marsden when I was leaving the Brompton, and I was like, you know, sometimes I feel guilty, like I can't talk about how I'm scared of dying because I don't have secondary breast cancer. But actually I have a cardiac condition that is as fatal, and that conversation isn't had enough. And so it's very difficult. Like, Thorold, you know, I lost my mum less than 2 years ago. I lost my dad less than 2 months ago. I lost my friend Nikki last month, and it's been really, really emotional. So I'm not sure how I am, if I'm honest, because then I've got 4 children to look after, and you can ask any mother, like, that's exhausting. And the work's tiring, but, you know, we do it because saving lives is so important to us. And so I'm not going to say I'm brilliant, because I'm not sure I am. But I think it's okay for us to also sit here and admit that as well, because that's super important. And sometimes it's nice because, like Doral says, I have her. And yesterday I left her with this ranting voicemail about, you know, blah, 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 my husband's done this and my sister's done, you know, just someone to offload on, because actually the people that we spend 24/7 with don't, sometimes they really just don't get it. And, you know, whilst my husband's walked the cancer path with me, he won't understand the emotional impact and, you know, the lasting imprint that it has on my life as well as someone who's been through breast cancer.
But also there's a massive, you know, as with my husband, there's a massive impact on them as well. Mm. And so you talked at the beginning of the podcast about how you sometimes, as a cancer patient, feel like a burden on others, which is something that I've massively felt. Mm. And so I try to minimise the stuff that I put on my closest loved ones. I try and put that stuff on other people instead. Mm. Because I don't want to add more pain and fear to what I'm sure they are already feeling, you know.
And there's a level of, I think a part of me wants a level of detachment in my home.
Yeah.
So it's nicer for me to talk about cancer with people who don't live in my same four walls, mm-hmm. because I kind of want those four walls to be a bit more sacred, and therefore I'm not as open with it. So I find it very awkward as well to talk about breast cancer, and you know, it's very complex, but I don't talk to my sister or my sister-in-law or my cousins about my breast cancer diagnosis. I talk to my community about it because I feel held there.
And that's partly why we're here with the Breast Cancer Now podcast, you know, because so, you know, everyone probably in this community feels like that to some degree. And so to have a place where people can come to just listen and feel like there's a friend on the other side of the earpiece.
And, you know, I think that's such a big thing. When I was first diagnosed back in 2006, pre-social media, the one thing that really helped me was Breast Cancer Now. They had a kind of a matching kind of a service where you could talk to someone on the telephone, like a telephone pen pal. Mm. And whilst I never met her, I have no idea what she looks like. You know, you weren't allowed to share kind of details apart from your cancer details. That helped me because I didn't know any other young people with breast cancer, and there was no one in the hospital that anyone like me. And the other day I was in, you know, waiting for my scan, and there was a younger woman who was South Asian, like the only woman of colour, and I was a bit like, oh my God, should I go talk to her? Like, you know, then I did it because I just thought I like a twit. But like, it was, you know, it's ridiculous that you know, we're as younger women, the three of us are sitting here, you know, all diagnosed before the age of 35. It's still rare, you know, only 4% of breast cancer is diagnosed to people under 40. And we're sitting here, and we're still always the youngest people there. And people are, why are we there? And I think having that community is even more important for us, where our natural life doesn't mean that we're meeting other people with breast cancer, if that makes sense. Mm.
Yeah. And similarly, when I was diagnosed, because, you know, Instagram wasn't as big back then, and I wasn't on it for sure. But what I did join through Facebook, I'd found younger women with breast cancer 2-day workshop. I went to that. Oh my God, you know, that was 10 years ago and we're still friends. You know, we were set up, we called ourselves on Facebook a little group called the Bionic Beauties, and we would meet up, you know, once a year and just talk on Facebook about things that we couldn't talk about with other people. And so facilitating those relationships, like, you know, we're still friends and we've lost some of our group. And we've mourned them together, and then we've celebrated milestones. So, you know, this year is 10 years for me. It's 10 years for my entire group, you know, of us who are still standing. And so every month we're all congratulating each other. And now the posts are coming on, oh, it's my last tamoxifen today, and it's my last this today. And it's just lovely that connection. We're not, we don't talk every day, but we're connected. And I think we will be forevermore.
If any of our listeners are, you know, wanting to find that person, then Breast Cancer Now actually still has a similar service called Someone Like Me. So if you just go online and search for Breast Cancer Now, Someone Like Me, or go on the Breast Cancer Now website, you can find that service. So there's one question that we're asking all of our guests on this podcast, which is, what is the one thing that you think needs to change in breast cancer?
So we need to collect more data, and we need more research, both in primary and secondary breast cancer, but particularly including marginalised groups, including people of colour and different ethnicities, but also other marginalised groups too.
Thank you.
For me, I think it's representation. Representation in media, representation in campaigns, representation in clinical trials, representation in sort of the oncology space overall.
Absolutely. Thank you. So where can people find South Asian Supernovas? And also, if people can get involved, how do they get involved?
So we're on all the major social media platforms under the handle at South Asian Supernovas. So, you know, we're on Instagram, TikTok, we've got a Facebook group. And that particular Facebook group is really useful because we put all sorts of opportunities in there, including kind of including patient groups and other conversations. And we do have a website too. So check us out.
And where can people find you personally?
I'm mainly on Instagram, just at Kreena Demand, or online at my website at www.kreenademand.com.
I'm on Instagram and Facebook at The Urban Kitchen, which is the name of my consultancy, and the website www.theurbankitchen.co.uk. And if you're a primary breast cancer patient, I have a integrative breast cancer course which can help you reduce your risk and support you through the cancer journey and beyond.
And we have put all of those links in the show notes, so people do not need to be furiously writing it down. Karina and Toril, thank you so much for joining us. This has been so enlightening, and I feel like I could have spoken to you for hours, and hopefully we will go on talking after the podcast, but thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. And
before we actually go, can we just say a massive thank you to Breast Cancer Now for all of the help with the campaign, because I'm not sure we could have brought it to life without all of the support of the team there. So thank you very much.
And in so many ways, from like marketing through to multimedia, through to everything, literally, you know, press releases, they've held our hands. And I think having that support has actually helped us to make it a reality.
It is a fantastic campaign, so congratulations, and I look forward to seeing where it goes in the next couple of years as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Breast Cancer Now podcast, make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Please also leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, and perhaps recommend it to someone you think would find it helpful. The more people we can reach, the more we can get Breast Cancer Now's vital resources to those who need them. You can find support and information on our website, breastcancernow.org, and you can follow Breast Cancer Now on social media at Breast Cancer Now. All the links mentioned in this episode are listed in the show notes in your podcast app. Thank you for listening to the Breast Cancer Now podcast.